there was a homework assignment. Norman wrote out all the instructions so nicely and printed them for me and then gave them to me and then went to Mexico and I lost them. So in the middle of his session in Mexico, he received a text from me, "Help!" And he texted me the instructions, so we're good. So study happiness. Is there such a thing as overall happiness? Happiness in moments? What makes you feel happy? What makes it impossible for you to feel happy? So that's your homework assignment. And if you had a chance to think about it in the last week, maybe you have some thoughts, or maybe thoughts will come to you as you hear other people share their thoughts. So would anyone like to start? Please. And now, what do we do with microphone, the microphone thing? Okay.
I've always liked Hitchcock's saying that happiness is a clear horizon, which works for me. But basically, I'm happy when I'm not suicidal as I was in my early 20s, depressed for years. Anything other than that, it feels like happiness to me.
Happiness for me is fulfilling a long-term goal that I've been working towards a long time and finally getting there.
Mm. Congratulations.
I don't think there is any such thing as happiness. I think you can be happy, but I think when people talk about happiness, I think what they're more looking for is something like contentment. That happiness, to say happiness is like to say someone's enlightened all the time. I mean, you feel good and you feel exhilarated, but no one feels that way all the time. That's why we have something called, we call it samsara. And so I think there really is no such thing as happiness. There's being happy, but being happy, if you try to get a hold of it and grab it and preserve it, it gets away as fast as it comes. So, no happiness. Anyone else?
That's the Zen happiness, no happiness.
We have Philip online.
Oh.
What came up for me at first, I was a little, Norman's gave us a really broad field to explore in his assignment. And one of the things that came up for me was there are at least two major philosophers who were really critical about the notion of happiness because of its possible conflict with our moral precepts. Kant was, and I just have a couple quick quotes, or one quick quote and one a little bit longer. Kant said, when one's own happiness is made determining ground of the will, the result is the opposite of the principle of morality. But it's just kind of a challenging notion of, and he saw it as egotism versus what we're influenced by in our moral. And the other quote that I'd like to, it's a little bit longer and maybe not very clear in some ways, it's by Emmanuel Levinas, had a really unique understanding of morality that was new and not different from Kant's anyhow. And he says in this book, which is his one of his texts, Otherwise Than Being, In this book, I speak of responsibility as the essential first fundamental structure of subjectivity. And this may not seem to be related to happiness at all, but it's like Kant's statement, it challenges the centrality that I know I have often and often do give in my life to happiness. He says it, again, the central first fundamental structure of subjectivity. This is because it is in ethical terms that I describe subjectivity. Ethics here is not presented as supplementing a pre-existing existential base. Rather, it is in ethics understood as responsibility that the very knot of the subjective is tied. And then finally, summarize humanity and its historical and objective existence, the opening of the subjective itself, of the human psyche, in its primordial vigilance and sober clear-headedness, is the being who delivers itself from its condition of being. It's disinterestedness. So he has this notion of being disinterested. And again, it's a far-fetched link maybe to a criticism of happiness, but one could say that happiness as a concept is kind of the essence of being interested in them. So anyhow, I just wanted to bring that in from left field. Thank you.
Thank you.
Professor.
Well, I have to say, I didn't think about it a whole lot. I just noticed it. That was my practice. And appreciated it. You know, so many things, I'm not going to define it, make me happy. You know, and they're little things often. And I just remembering to appreciate the things that make me happy since the last time we talked. And it's been really lovely to, you know, thank you, happiness.
Nice. Yeah, that's what I was thinking too, is gratitude. And I mean, it's so trite to say, oh, gratitude is my practice. But, you know, really, that is true. And happiness is recognizing one's gratitude for all the small things, and there's a lot of small things that mm-hmm. I'm grateful for.
Well, as Neil started to talk, I was thinking about something earlier today that made me happy. I was on the freeway, and Neil had told me that he was very impressed with the way Mary drives. She goes very much her own speed, which is not necessarily the speed that other people are going to slow. And he admired that so much. And I realized that I was getting a transmission from Mary through Neil, and it made me very happy to have these kinds of connections. Truly, it does. And to me, knowing I was coming here, you know, that made me happy as well.
Yeah. That's the thing an old lady does.
Yes, I would say that the older I get, the lower my standard for happiness becomes. I used to have a very high standard. Not so much.
Sue online?
Well, maybe this is connected to what Philip was saying, and it's a comment about sort of happiness in general, not those wonderful little moments of happiness that come when a bird hops around. But some years ago, I was talking to a close friend of mine, and I was telling her I was worried about one of my sons who wasn't really happy with his work. And she said, and I said, I just want him to be happy. I don't care what work he does, I just want him to be happy. And she said, that's not a very Buddhist thing to say. And he wasn't Buddhist, but And I said, well, what do you mean? And she said, well, he's okay. Happiness is overrated. Happiness is overrated. And, you know, I thought about that and it made a big impression on me because I think in a sense, it is overrated, the certain kind of happiness that we're loving for and hoping for. And if we can just lower our standards and enjoy the moments that come, that's different from wanting lifetime happiness unrolling ahead of us.
Thank you.
And Meryl?
So on this, I'm going to call it issue of happiness, which is always a little, I think, problematic for a Zen student, in particular a Zen student. The best response I have comes from a poem that was introduced to us at Tassajara by Paul Haller from the great Palestinian poet Taha Muhammad Ali. If you don't know him, you really should. He kind of he just came upon us maybe 15 years ago, and everyone really got thrilled with him. But this poem is called Warning. Lovers of hunting and beginners seeking your prey, don't aim your rifles at my happiness, which isn't worth the price of the bullet you'd waste on it. What seems to you so fine and nimble like a fawn and flees every which way like a partridge isn't happiness. Trust me, my happiness bears no relation to happiness. Well, that's it. That's all I have.
Thank you. Right. Well, thank you. That made me happy. So let's see what Norman has to say here that I'm supposed to do next. I think my talk might be next. I think that's the okay. So tonight we're doing the Ryakufasat ceremony at the end of so that means that we'll be aware of the time. How much time do we need for that ceremony? Set up, including set up and the whole thing?
Yeah, so 6:20, if we could set up, we could do the ceremony at 6:30 and be out of here by 7.
Okay, so 6:20, that means we might skip small groups tonight, because that's just, we might have just time for a few questions instead. Is that okay with everybody?
Yeah.
You could convene afterwards and have small groups at restaurants and places like that, if you wanted. So it's 5:45, so we'll have about 35 minutes of this session. So if that's okay with you, let us do that. And then I believe that Norman says there's a short service, but we're not doing a short service tonight, right? Yeah, you forgot that. We have this. Can you hear? No?
If you could speak up a little bit, I think that would help.
Okay. Is this good? Closest. Is that any better? Is that better right there? Okay. We're in. So, you know, go like that if you can't hear. Don't just sit there and suffer, or maybe you prefer not to hear, but don't just sit there and not hear. Make some noise or hand gestures that are noticeable. So it's my turn to talk about verses 16 and 17. And so I sat down with those verses and I really enjoyed them, especially 16. I enjoyed both of them a lot. Thinking about, you know, these old teachings and what the Dhammapada has gone through, how many people have read the Dhammapada over the years, and added, you know, added to it and or added their thoughts and commentary to it, and how important it is in our tradition. It was, it's just a lovely document, as I'm sure that you are noticing. I think I'll start by just reading. I think I'll just read 16, and this I have Gil Fronsdale's version. I have the other one too, but I think I'll just read this one. I'm just going to read it through, and then I'll have some things to say. The deer. Practicing what one shouldn't, nor not practicing what one should, having abandoned the goal, clinging to what is dear, one comes to envy those who practice. Don't get entangled with what you long for or dislike. Not seeing what you long for is suffering. So also is seeing what you dislike. Therefore, do not turn anything into something longed for then it is dreadful to lose. Without longing or dislike, no bonds exist. Excuse me. And then the next five verses are this beautiful kind of rhythmic repetition. Longing gives rise to grief. Longing gives rise to fear. For someone released from longing, there is neither grief nor fear. Affection gives rise to grief. Affection gives rise to fear. For someone released from affection, there is no grief. And from where would come fear? Infatuation gives rise to grief. Infatuation gives rise to fear. For someone released from infatuation, there is no grief. And from where would come fear? Sensual craving gives rise to grief. Sensual craving gives rise to fear. For someone released from sensual craving, there is no grief. And from where would come fear? Craving gives rise to grief. Craving gives rise to fear. For someone released from craving, there is no grief. And from where would come fear? You know, there's a couple more verses that aren't in that rhythm, but as I'm sure you know, a lot of this old stuff is repetitive like that because it was memorized and passed on from generation to generation for several hundred years. People hold dear those who have done their own work, complete in virtue and vision, established in the Dhamma, and who speak the truth. Anyone who aspires to the indescribable, whose mind is expansive, and whose heart is not bound to sensual craving, is called one bound upstream. Relatives, friends, and companions rejoice when a long absent person returns from afar. Just so, in passing from this world to the next, the merit we have made receives us as a family does the return of a beloved relative. So I think I was going to read both straight through, but I think I'll read that and then read to you what my thoughts about that are, and then we'll switch to verse 17, if that's okay. So what comes to my mind in reading these verses, especially in the line, clinging to what is dear, is how we are inclined to think and see the world as subject and object. I am subject going about my day, encountering multiple objects successively. Some of these objects I know, some I don't, though I quickly assess and judge those objects I meet for the first time. The objects I know today are pretty much the same as they were yesterday, And I'm pretty much the same as I was yesterday, though a little bit older. In this setting or worldview that I just portrayed, it sounds like practicing means fixing my mind on a particular attitude or stance or verse or words or something like that. Some practice or stance with which I can encounter these multiple objects. And as soon as I forget that practice, or just get tired of that practice and fall back in the soup. Maybe some scary images or embarrassment or boredom inspire me to get back to the practice, which will someday in the future release me from my bad habits. So this scenario that I just described reminds me of the song about Santa Claus. He sees you when you're sleeping, he knows when you're awake, he knows when you've been bad or good, so be good for goodness sake. This sort of description of religious practice may sound both familiar and ridiculous, because this is how we teach children. We tell them about the big bad wolf so they will be scared, which may keep them out of harm's way. You know, if you ask a child, what would you do if you were in the street and a car was driving toward you really fast? The child is likely to say, I would just punch that car out of my way. And this is because children live in a different world from us. A magical world in which anything is possible. That's why we love their company. They live in the ultimate beginner's mind world. But to keep them safe, maybe we must scare them, bribe them, manipulate them. We probably spent years of our lives in that sort of world, and the flavor still lingers. If I am good, according to these weird external standards that I don't understand, I might be rewarded. Buddhism has done great work in addressing this dilemma and pointing us in the direction of growing up. For example, suffering, impermanence, and no self, the three marks of existence taught by the Buddha. Footnote, no self is a little different from emptiness. Emptiness, as we know, emerged several hundred years after Buddha. Still though, no self means we are composed of discrete capacities, behaviors, components, but there is no real unifying boss or entity that endures over our lifetime or successive lifetimes. Our sense of an enduring self is a phantom. Yet, this phantom self is present, is vivid, is compelling. It's a deeply ingrained habit, reinforced by our families, communities, cultures, histories, and by evolution. We can't get rid of it exactly. We can take that self and expand it, for example. So one constant refrain in our lives and in Buddhist teachings has to do with self and other, subject and object. What is self and other? Clinging to what is dear, one comes to envy those who practice. Clinging to what is dear is an enactment of self and other. So to take that experience and expand it could mean softening, dissolving the boundary between self and other, like with the practice of generosity, of gratitude, of forgiveness. Since what I have is so dear to me, I share it with you. Through this practice, the boundary between self and other becomes permeable, not fixed. And my behavior toward others changes. Maybe not in an overarching, sweeping way, maybe just person by person, bit by bit. One characteristic of our practice is that we notice the little bit. We stay with it and allow it to grow, like planting a seed in the earth. The self and other, or subject-object dichotomy, is useful, and it is provisional, and it is self-created. So we can learn to spot that and drop it when it's not needed. Self and other is a tool that we don't need to carry around all the time. We can put it down when it's not needed. Do not turn anything into something longed for. Suffering. I want to tell you something that I heard many years ago in one of those old talks by Alan Watts. He talked about suffering. The word in Sanskrit is dukkha. However, he said, suffering is not just dukkha. The opposite of suffering is sukha. So it's like the sad and the happy. Alan Watts, his explanation is that they are partners in causing suffering, dukkha and sukha. When we do have something we want, we long for that thing. When we do not have something we want, we long for that thing that we aren't or don't have. This is dukkha. When we get something we want, we are delighted in having or being that thing. Then almost immediately we stress out about losing that thing. Together, this is suffering. The dukkha-sukha train is suffering, and we go bonga, bonga, bonga. We get what we want and we're happy, and then we get scared of losing it and we get a bigger padlock on our door, and then we lose it and we're so sad and oh my gosh, poor me. And then we get what we want and we think, how do I deserve this? Wait, I do deserve it. And then we lose it and we go back to dukkha and we think, why is it always me? Oh, I so deserve this. I mean, that's our drama, you know. So back and forth and back and forth. The dukkha sukha is what Alan Watts was saying. That's the suffering. I thought that was brilliant. I mean, I had never heard anyone describe suffering that way, and I know that we have a big. We have a lot of problems with certain words as they were translated into English, and suffering is one of them. And it's a lot more subtle than just the English word suffering. So the dukkha-sukha train depends on our perception of self and other. Again, self and other is a useful tool. Our practice has a lot to do with learning how to put that tool down when it is not needed. And how do we do that? It's really simple. Putting a tool down, you just open your hands and the tool falls down. You get off the train, you know, slip out the back, Jack. The next five stanzas are repetitive and to me are reminiscent of the five skandhas. The skandhas describe the components of the human experience. The verses seem to describe the process of becoming enmeshed in relation to our other, giving rise to grief and fear. Grief of not getting the other, and having gotten the other, fear of losing it. That's the dukkha-sukha train. The last three stanzas of this verse describe sort of the reverberations, or if Heidi is present, the resonance that's someone who engages in practice with others, that someone who engages in practice has with others. They have done the work and are complete in virtue and vision, established in Dharma, who speak the truth. Their mind is expansive. Their heart is not bound. That means bound to sensual craving. When passing from this world, death receives such a person as a family does with the return of a beloved relative. So those are my notes on verse 16. And, you know, we want to finish at 6:20. Maybe we could stop and see if there are any comments about this verse, because the next verse will change the tone a little bit.
I think I can take in all of this and make sense to me. The one that I struggle with, and I wonder if all of the translations use the same word, affection, no. The one that affection gives rise to grief. And I understand if you have feelings of affection for somebody, you can lose them, so you grieve. Is it as simple as that? I don't know. I just don't get that one very well. It's as if affection is a detriment.
Yeah. Yeah. It's. I mean, if we put the word love in, it would make sense, total sense to us. The English word love would make sense, because the English word love, which I want to repossess as a Zen word, but I'm working on it, but it's a sticky word in English. So that sentence, love, what is it again, turns to grief.
To be released from affection, there is no grief. It doesn't sound like a good thing to me. That's all I'm saying.
To release...
For someone released from affection, there is no grief.
Okay.
Well, that may be true, but that's like saying I'm not going to love it because I don't want to hurt.
Are you on Gill's translation?
Yes.
Yeah. Show me where it is.
213.
My pages are different.
Yeah.
Pardon?
Is it the verse number was 215?
Yeah, the verse number is 213.
I don't know if they're the same. Oh, I see. There it is. Very small. For someone released from affection, there is no grief. Oh, it means, this is affection. This is affection in the sense of attachment.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering, because affection is different to me.
Yeah, affection gives rise to grief. Yeah. Affection gives rise to fear. So we're talking about the attachment affection.
Because affection makes me happy.
I know. I don't know what the word would be, but,
yeah.
You know, I don't know. Yes.
I had a similar reaction to without longing or dislike, no bonds exist. It's verse 211. And I guess it's a similar thing without attachment. But bonds, I thought more of almost interconnectivity, create bonds with people. But maybe it's getting lost in the translation for me.
Yeah, the bonds, I bet, means bounded. You know, we are bound by bonds, kind of mm-hmm. bond. Because the word bonds in English can go both ways, just like the word affection, I think. But I think that's what it means. We are bound by... When we are released from these clinging things, we are not bound. Yeah. I have some commentary about that, I think, in the next part of my talk. But anyway.
Yeah,
Anybody else?
Yeah, question. So you said something to the effect of self and other, we can drop it sometimes, or, you know, it's needed. It sounded like it was needed sometimes, but we didn't need it all the time.
That's how I think of it. When I go to the grocery store, I park my car, and I go into the grocery store with my shopping list, and I pay for it with my money, and then I walk back out to my car. And I need to get that all straightened out in my mind, because if I go haywire, it won't turn out well. So that sense of, you know, I know who I am and I know my place, but it's like I said, it's like a tool. We live that way as a tool. You know, we could reinvent ourselves and say, well, how about everybody just show up, all of us have an assignment. We show up at the grocery store at a certain time in the week, we all go in and we shop, and then it's arbitrary who goes home with the basket of food that we just picked out. You know, it's arbitrary. We're just gonna pay for the food and give it to somebody else who's gonna give theirs to us. I mean, how would that work? But you could imagine, I mean, don't get me started, about the island called Yap. Have I ever told you about the island called Yap? On the island of Yap, they have stone money. And the stone money is, sometimes it's 10 feet tall. It's just big, heavy stones. And they're carved stones. And that's the money. So on the island of Yap, if you acquire this money, you can't bring it home. It's too heavy. So you move your house next to the stone. So consequently, rich people and poor people all live in these little shacks. Everybody's house looks the same. It's just that if you're rich, you live next to this stone. That means you're rich. Crazy, huh? Isn't that a good idea? But I mean, like, we could reinvent our system. Our system is what it is, but it doesn't have to be. But it really is. We really do live with a sense of self and other. We have to keep that straight. But we can also learn that that idea is not gonna go anywhere, but it's kind of an arbitrary idea. It's a tool, and we can put it down when we're not using it.
When you go to that part where you're reading the repeating phrases about grief and so on, it felt a little black and white to me. It was a good instruction that I got that I really was helpful to me in Zazen early on, which was about discomfort.
Mm-hmm.
The instruction was go a little way into it, then move. You know, go a little way into it. I feel that applies to an awful lot of things we might do in this world. We can go a little way into them without clinging to them, and that way we have a life.
Yes, yeah. I agree.
It's time. Philip has a comment.
Thank you. I just wanted to mention the second verse, don't get entangled, and the whole tone, feeling tone of this, this year, chapter 16, resonates for me with Bob Dylan. Such a beautiful depiction or expression of the feeling of this for me of this.
Thank you. Can we go on? Was somebody? Oh, go ahead. No, please go ahead, and you'll be the last. We want to keep an eye on the clock here.
That's wonderful to hear that.
Yeah.
I think we don't find that too often with this text, some sort of acknowledgement of the amount of work it is and how it has to be your own work.
Yeah.
You can't assume somebody else's wisdom.
Yeah. That whole last couple of, especially the last line, isn't that beautiful?
Yes.
Okay. On to anger. It reads, "Give up anger, give up conceit, pass beyond every fetter. There is no suffering for one who possesses nothing, who doesn't cling to body and mind. The one who keeps anger in check as it arises, as one would a careening chariot, I call a charioteer. Others are merely rein holders. Conquer anger with non-anger. Conquer wickedness with goodness. Conquer stinginess with giving, and a liar with truth. If one speaks the truth, is not angry, and gives when asked, even when one has little, then one comes into the presence of the gods. Sages who do no harm, constantly restrained in body, go to the immovable state where they do not grieve. For the ever wakeful, training day and night intent on nirvana, the toxins disappear. Ancient is this saying, O Atula. It is not just of today. They find fault in one sitting silently. They find fault in one speaking much. They find fault in one speaking moderately. No one in this world is not found at fault. No person can be found who has been, is, or will be only criticized or is praised, or is only praised. Who is worthy enough to find fault is one who is like a coin of the finest gold, blameless in conduct, intelligent, endowed with insight and virtue, praised by the wise after being observed day after day. Such a one is praised even by the gods, even by Brahma. Guard against anger erupting in your body. Be restrained with your body. Letting go of bodily misconduct, practice good conduct with your body. Guard against anger erupting in your speech. Be restrained in your speech. Letting go of verbal misconduct, practice good conduct with your speech. Guard against anger erupting in your mind. Be restrained with your mind. Letting go of mental misconduct, practice good conduct with your mind. The wise are restrained in body, restrained in speech. The wise are restrained in mind. They are fully restrained. So, what I wanted to say about that verse, or those verses, first of all, I want to say that anger is part of our emergency alert system, along with fear and some other things. Animals like us lived through a lot of evolution thanks to anger, and it should be respected. The verses on anger seem to refer to anger as self-clinging. Give up anger, give up conceit. Pass beyond every fetter. There is no suffering for one who possesses nothing. Who doesn't cling to body and mind? I read this and I think, yes, anger can be like a wild animal, dangerous, disruptive, and destructive. And if we want to live with a wild animal, we must train it. It must be housebroken. It must learn who I am and learn to respect my wishes, and vice versa. This is like the next line. The one who keeps anger in check as it arises, as one would a careening chariot, I call a charioteer. I appreciate this image of the value, the dignity of anger as a chariot that one needs to acquire the skill to handle in the right time and place. I think this is important to us right now as we engage in or try to figure out, or try to figure out how to engage in the events of the day. Activists learn how to allow anger to arise and subside, then discern how to best interact with the situation and get to work. Activists who don't learn that burn out. Fact is, everyone burns out sometimes. The theme of these verses for me is not about how I can be relieved of the pain of anger or desire, because these experiences simply go with the territory of being alive. It's similar to Hui Neng's comment about trying to stop thoughts in sitting practice. You know Hui Neng? Hui Neng says, once your thoughts stop, you die. It must be true of feelings too. He's talking about thoughts. It must be true of feelings too. Hui Neng says, just don't attach. Let them flow. When anger arises, we allow it. We notice the physical sensations, like heat in the chest, in the neck, and in the head. Increased heart rate, shallow breath, fast popping thoughts and images. We allow it to wash through us like a storm. Just don't attach, especially to the thoughts. As though in a storm, just manage the boat. I can't control the storm. Knowing my boat is my best chance to get through the storm safely. And in our meditation practice, we can learn to refrain from a subject-object relationship with ourselves. We sort of need that relationship to function in our work and home. And we can learn to open our hands, put down that duality tool when we sit, or when we walk to the car, when we get in line at the grocery store, when we wash the dishes. Maybe we don't need that tool just now. We can let go of our subject-object relationship with our experience. When we feel longing, refrain from attaching that feeling to an object. And just be longing. When we feel grief, love, fear, anger, joy, refrain from attaching those feelings to an object, and just be with those human experiences. Allow them to arise and allow them to fall away in their own time. So that's what I wanted to say about that verse, that there's something about the anger verse. Certain parts of it did not speak to me, and I thought, why? Anyway, that's what I have to say about it. We have, no minutes. I wish we had time to discuss this, because I think that especially the anger one is pertinent to us.
Could we make time next week?
5 minutes?
Yeah.
Make it homework.
Let's take 5 minutes, can we?
Sure.
Okay. We'll chant fast today.
No, we won't.
Just kidding.
I had trouble with the word restrained in the last verse, and maybe it's something with something in my mind restraining. Like you restrain an animal, you have ties to hold something back, and I would think, I would prefer a different image of how one deals with anger instead of sort of being tied and restrained.
Yeah. That's why I wanted to say we can fully feel our anger, and what we restrain ourselves from is punching somebody. You know, in Zazen or out of Zazen, or we restrain entertaining in Zazen about how much I hate that person and how they made me angry. We restrain ourselves from that, you know, from making our anger into an object that we need to act on or can possibly act on. We can just take anger as fully felt without anything more.
You know, I think that hate is anger that's become fossilized, become solid. And prejudice, for example, is about something happened that provoked some anger at some point, or maybe you got it from someone else, from someone at an early age. But by the time it becomes prejudice, it's beyond anything that you're feeling. It's just fossil. It's like solid.
It's belief. Yeah.
So I think one of the great dangers of anger is not to let it become solid.
Yeah.
Because then it's much harder to retreat from it.
Yeah.
And leave it behind.
Yeah.
I really like the opening line. Give up anger, give up conceit.
Mm-hmm.
How it turns you back, you know, your anger is really your anger. It's not what somebody else is doing, it's your anger.
Yeah.
So it's all about me, not about them. And I really like the way it does it, just in that little line tells you, reminds you.
Yeah.
I was kind of going in that same place. I was thinking that sometimes when we're angry, we feel righteous. That anger can make you feel really righteous about something, and it becomes more about us. And it's not useful. You have to get past that if you really want to be effective in making change for something. You have to give up that righteousness, I'm right, they're wrong feeling,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, and we know that, I mean, anger is very energetic. It's this raw energy, and there's a lot of, mental components to it, like, I'm right, I have a right to be this, and I have a right to do this, and so on and so forth. And, you know, that's those thoughts that accompany the feeling and the image that accompanies the feeling, that's where our work is, I think. Yeah. We haven't heard from anybody online. Should we? Anlor? Oh, let's. Maybe Anlor will be our last, and I apologize to people online.
Yeah, I just really liked it. I've thought of that often, the last...
Can you hold the mic up,
please? I don't have the book, but you know where it says, we find wrong with somebody who's too silent, we find wrong with somebody, or I don't know how to say it.
Yeah.
I just love it.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
This is, to me, speaking to our differences too, and accepting our differences.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's also speaking to our critical muscle, our human critical muscle, which we exercise regularly, you know. Well, thank you so much. I think, do we chant? What do we just do a wrap-up chant, or should we just move into the ceremony?
I bow to you.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
Yeah, thank you.
Wonderful. And so we're going to set up for the ceremony. And so...
Recording stopped.
If you can...